We're back and getting set for UFC 292. Sterling taking on Sean O'Malley, Craig Allen, Matt Allen. The show is back together, and we are looking forward to a big week in fights. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. And just like that, the UFC shipping up to Boston and looking forward to the promotion's return since Fight Night Weidman versus Reyes back in 2019. As always, one half of your host duo, Craig Allen, X and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, he's back again from the European swing. Will he code switch like he's Madonna? I don't know. But what I do know is we're looking forward to breaking down these fights together again. Last week, I was rowing on the St. John River. The week before, I was doing it on the solo on the other side of the screen. But this weekend, a title fight in the main event, Aljamain Sterling taking on Sean O'Malley. What a rise it's been since Contender Series 2017 for the young O'Malley. And for Sterling, his sixth straight title fight in a row, looking to roll. His last time out, he was able to get it done against Henry Cejudo. Co-main event, 36 wins between them and 30 of them by finish. We have China Zhang Weili taking on Amanda Lemos. And of course, this is a really interesting fight card because it's a culmination of The Ultimate Fighter Season 31 at lightweight. We already know it's going to be Austin Thud Hubbard taking on Kurt Hollibaugh for that lightweight crown. But we also have the bantamweights finishing up. And this week, we're going to figure out who fights the former Ultimate Fighter winner, Brad Katona. Will it be Boston's own Rico DiSciullo? Or will it be Cody Gibson getting the win? The lone prospect still going in the semifinals is Rico DiSciullo. But Matt, I know you're really excited for this card. A lot of former top contenders, a lot of former main event stars as well. A few different prospects, I guess you could call that, layered in there. A lot to look forward to in a card like this.
What a fight like Brad Tavares versus Chris Weidman is buried on the prelims. It just kind of speaks to the overall depth of the card.
And will it be buried on the prelims? Because for the countdown this week, that fight actually got its own breakaway video.
Which is justified, and that's a fight that I've really been looking forward to, because of course Chris Weidman quite famously had that awful leg injury the last time out against Uriah Hall, and it has been a long road back. He's spoken quite openly about just how difficult the rehab's been coming back from that injury, and Brad Tavares is another one of these fighters you just kind of know what you're going to get, right? Has he been a top five guy in the division? Has he been a guy you think is going to fight for the title? No, not necessarily, but he's a tough out for anybody, and I think it's a great return fight for a guy like Weidman.
Brad Tavares, the boiled meat and potatoes of the UFC, no rookies and no sophomore showings on this card. A lot to look forward to break down here. And as fights adjust, which we have seen Neil Magny now taking on Ian Machado Gary, you also have the fact that there was supposed to be a Rob Font Song Yadong fight on this card. That fell out, as well as Cejudo versus Vera. That's no more, but we do have replacements. So as things change, you're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. And just like that, we're back with Fight Night Picks, and we have the culmination of The Ultimate Fighter Season 31. The lightweights, they are at it, and this was a really, really interesting season for The Ultimate Fighter, because if you didn't watch it, let's break it down a little bit. It was the veterans versus the prospects, and at the first coin toss, Conor McGregor gets his pick, and he picks the prospects. So Chandler gets the veterans, and then Chandler gets the second pick, and he picks the veterans, so McGregor gets the prospects, and ultimately at lightweight, we end up with a couple of veterans, Austin Hubbard and Kurt Hollibaugh, and you probably know these fighters quite well. Kurt Hollibaugh looking to make it a third time in the UFC, like he's Juicy J Julian Arosa, and for Austin Hubbard, a 3-4 run in the UFC his first time out. And Hubbard was one of those guys, LFA lightweight champ before he came in. He had some memorable fights in the UFC not that long ago. I was actually surprised when I found out that Austin Hubbard was fighting with a regional promotion. I thought he was still around. Didn't even realize that they had cut him quite a while ago, a couple years ago. And if you look at it for Kurt Hollibaugh, he came in off of Strikeforce. He loses to Steven Seiler in his first UFC fight at UFC 158. He then strings together three fights in the UFC. A fight of the night loss to Jaime Barcelos, where he gets finished in the third round. He drops Shane Burgos with a four-punch combo, only to dive himself into an armbar, and then he ends up losing a third straight fight against Thiago Moises. So Hollabaugh has to pick up the pieces. He wins a couple of fights in the regional scene, but he hadn't fought from 2021 until 2023 in The Ultimate Fighter. So a long layoff for Hollabaugh, and on the season of The Ultimate Fighter, Hollabaugh, first of all, draws Team McGregor, and it was a Team McGregor guy out of SBG, Lee Hammond. He's losing until a final Hail Mary. Like, he's Tim Couch with my Cleveland Browns in 1999, and he lands the submission victory. And so for Hollabaugh, he wins that fight. He wins his second fight over there as well. He has an absolute blood and guts war against Jason Knight. But he also beats the piss out of Jason Knight for two rounds, and then he ends up getting the TKO win. And for Austin Hubbard, his first fight, he gets a win fairly convincingly. His second fight, he goes out there, wins by split decision against his, roommate or teammate in Roosevelt Roberts. I've never seen a more boring fight in The Ultimate Fighter. Dana White hated it. I thought it looked like a couple of guys that were in a sparring match and didn't want to fight each other.
I think that's a little harsh, but you're not completely wrong. Like, it was not the best fight by any means, but that's the thing about Austin Hubbard. He's not going in there and finishing a lot of fighters, and you even see that in the fights that he had after he had left the UFC. They are both decision wins on his record.
Over who? Just let me bang, bro? Julian Lane?
Exactly. Julian Lane is the first guy that he won over, but you still see the things that kind of got him to the big dance in those decision wins. He has really nice front kicks, and that's the one thing about Austin Hubbard's game that I do really enjoy. He does a good job of at least using the range and using his kicks while at distance, but before he does start to incorporate his own boxing techniques. And for Hubbard, it is kind of you gotta walk that real fine line, right? Because if he is too far in, other guys are going to be able to outpower punch him if they really do sit down on their shots. But at distance, he can have success in elongated terms of success in the majority of these fights. But the problem with Hubbard has been for the long time, it is that close range. Because if you are that powerful boxer, you're gonna be able to hit him harder than he hits you. And if you can kind of crowd those kicks and start to go for your own takedown attempts, he doesn't necessarily have that second and third note to his game afterwards. And for Kurt Hollabaugh, I'm glad you bring up the Shane Burgos drop, because that's the weirdest fight of all time, because it tells you the exact opposite about both fighters that you would assume. Wait, Kurt Hollabaugh dropped Shane Burgos and then gets submitted by Shane Burgos off his back? Very uncharacteristic performance from both of those guys, because Hollabaugh is a very talented submission grappler when he's able to get the fight to the ground. He does a really good job of going from head and arm chokes into arm bars and whatnot, and it does make you think about not just the initial sequences, but also what's going to come next. But that's why, again, and I know we're going to talk about this, it is really hard to predict a fight like this, because like you had mentioned, Kurt Hollabaugh, this would be the third time around in the UFC for him, and rarely, I'm going to bring up Busted Open. It was a show that was on before Luke Thomas on SiriusXM, and I remember there was a grown man on there crying once, because a guy said, well, Ric Flair's a 17-time world champion. Doesn't that mean he lost 16 times? And a grown man got brought to tears because of that fact. That's kind of what you have to say about a guy like Kurt Hollabaugh. If he's making his third run in the UFC, unless he is adding some brand new element to his game, I just don't really know where either guy goes from here if they win. It's going to be great. You win the Ultimate Fighter. You get that cool, like, glass trophy thing. But then, is it just going to be the same old Austin Hubbard and the same old Kurt Hollabaugh in the UFC afterwards? Because we kind of know how that story ends, don't we?
Well, and that's what we've seen out of Austin Hubbard. It's still real to me, damn it. You watch the first episode, he's taken on Aaron McKenzie, r/MMAZone. The guy's all over Reddit, and he has been. And in that one, it's defending a lot of takedowns, using his own offensive pressure, getting the back of McKenzie, getting him down, and landing some ground and pound. And from Hubbard in the UFC run, whether it's his fight against Kyle Prepelec, where he loses the first round, but then he rallies in the second and the third, if Hubbard's a better wrestler than his opponent, he wins. If he's a worse wrestler, then he loses. You saw that against Mark Madsen. Even though Hubbard rallied in the third round of that fight, you saw him lose against Davi Hamosh because he wasn't a better grappler. That was in the debut. Hubbard, what we've seen is he's not the fastest on the feet. When it comes to his boxing or his kicks, there's a reset. He's kind of slow. He takes his time. Kurt Hollabaugh, even at 36, I think he's a faster fighter. I think he can go out there and land some of his own shots. But Austin Hubbard has that big X factor of the teep kicks to the body. And Hubbard, I saw him check a couple of leg kicks in his fight against McKenzie, in his fight, in his second one out. But that's Roosevelt Roberts. That is a guy in Aaron McKenzie. Against Kurt Hollabaugh, you could say the same thing. These two guys combined in the UFC, it's a 3-8 record. So it is a little bit salty. But Hubbard in that fight against Prepelec, that was the one where after the fact, he had to go to the hospital, compartment syndrome in his leg, because Hubbard doesn't check any leg kicks, like at all. he will have a little bit of an advantage in just about every single fight. And we know Austin Hubbard's of that class, like a Charles Johnson. If every round was a 5-round fight, Austin Hubbard would outlast everybody and win every fight because he's trained at elevation for so long. And he's going to be kind of fortunate because he has a teammate now on this card in Neil Magny that gets to make the trip out to Boston with him. So when it does come down to this one, Holaba, you kind of mentioned it, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in his back pocket. And Holaba does have some tidy wins on his record. Outside of the UFC, he beat Dez Green for the Titan lightweight strap before losing to Andre Harrison. Where at a point, like, nobody could beat Andre Harrison until he went into the PFL.
Like Goldberg in 1999.
Everybody could beat him, and Holaba was on the initial season of The Ultimate Fighter. He beat Matt Bissett, but that one's a no contest because he had a little bit of the IV rehydration after the fact. So when we have a look at this fight, Matt, the finals of the lightweight tournament for The Ultimate Fighter, you've got a guy in Austin Hubbard. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Only 485 of them, 70% Hubbard, 89% by decision for the 30% that have Holaba, 52% by decision, 34% by knockout. Both of these guys, I'd say Hubbard, much more difficult to finish out of the two. But when you're trying to make a pick on this one, do you kind of want to edge the younger fighter in the match?
Personally, I do. And I do think it does come down to his ability to go out there and win third rounds. Now, if you lose the first two, it doesn't really matter how good you look in the third if you're not able to get the finish. But Hubbard is one of those fighters. He just, if he was a little bit more heavy-handed, if he had a little bit more pop, he's a bit like Fariseum. Not exactly. But Fariseum, I've always said about him, is his striking really nice to look at? It is. But if he just hit like 15% harder, he'd be that much better. For Hubbard, I know it does help him because he's not throwing everything into every shot. So it does allow his cardio to be so good in that third round. And that's why I am going to pick him in this fight. I think at kicking range, he's going to be able to do enough to at least keep Holaba off of him. And I think that'll help him win some of the earlier moments of this fight. And if it does go down the stretch, if there's not a ton of grappling from both guys where Hubbard could get exhausted, I do think he'll be able to win the third. And for that reason, I think he'll get the win.
And we saw Holaba, even just on the season, struggle with the takedown and the pressure of a guy like Lee Hammond, and Holaba's traditionally struggled with wrestling defense. So if Hubbard goes in there and goes for the takedowns quickly, he could find himself in some pretty advantageous positions because he keeps things pretty darn tight when he is on the mat. I like Holaba though with the activity. I think his striking is going to be a difference maker. Once they get into a phone booth, Holaba, I perceive, has an advantage there. So we're splitting the pick in this one, and I'd really be eager to hear who the fans have. A couple of UFC vets here battling it out for the Ultimate Fighter trophy. Hubbard versus Holaba. Let us know who you have in the comments section. We have some big time fights left on this card. Two title fights up at the top. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
The rematch, 8 years, 9 months, and 18 days in the making that you didn't know you needed in the UFC. Coming up this weekend, we have Killer Karine Silva looking to hold on to that nickname and hope that Juliana Miller retired it last weekend. Silva rematching with the Iron Lady, Marina Moroes. And if you didn't know that this was a rematch, well, back years ago, Karine Silva was 21 years old taking on 23-year-old Marina Moroes. And I've talked about this fight, it seems like, every time Silva and every time Moroes fight. But if you go back and you watch it, it was actually Marina Moroes' stepping stone into the UFC to then take on Joanne Calderwood as a plus 550 underdog, get a performance of the night bonus with a first-round armbar win. And if you watch Silva versus Moroes, the same thing happens. But from the outset, the fight starts off and Karine Silva looks like a much bigger fighter. She runs in there, throws the superwoman punch. They clinch up. Moroes pulls guard. Silva plays around a little bit. She kind of gets to a decent position where she's stacking. Moroes is looking armbar. Silva stands back up. They go back down to the mat once more and Moroes is able to sync up that armbar. And the rest is history, so you would think. Not quite. Silva's had a wild run on the regional scene. Since that fight against Marina Moroes, Karine Silva is 11-2, and the two losses are against really good fighters. Exactly. And the wins are against some decent fighters. Silva fought on Contender Series. She comes into the UFC. You're still not maybe 100% sold. She gets a performance bonus against Pauliana Battaglio. And Silva's last time out, she was supposed to take on a bigger name, but the fight gets scratched. So she ends up with the Invicta flyweight champ, Ketlyn Souza. And I was excited to see Ketlyn Souza. And I hope I'll get to see Ketlyn Souza in the UFC maybe one day, because Karine Silva took her leg home with her. So
it was such a nice
Silva,
submission.
Every single win of finish throughout her career. For Marina Rose, the highs have been high, the lows have been low in the UFC, but in her last fight, she was riding a 3-fight win streak. She had some finishes in her back pocket. She takes on former challenger of the flyweight strap, Jennifer Maia, and Marina Rose is pretty well a 2-1 favorite. Most people thought that Rose would win, and boy, did she ever get ground out in that attempt. So now you're in a buy-low situation with Rose, a buy-high situation with Silva, and they get to rematch here.
Marina Rose had a really weird run in the UFC, and when I first started thinking about this fight, I just saw a commercial. They're bringing Wipeout back. Fun fact, Wipeout's a great show.
American Wipeout or Canadian Wipeout?
Well, John Cena's going to be the host, so it's American Wipeout. But you remember that one section of the course where just all those boxing gloves that are coming out all over the place? That's kind of how Maria Moroz does fight. Now, all those shots aren't going to connect similar to in Wipeout. All those punches do not connect. But it really is a sea of punches that you have to wade yourself through before you are able to have success against her. She really is in that cut of Caitlin Chookagian is another fighter like that, where you're just going to realize, okay, I'm going to have to eat a couple of shots before I have my own success, but they're not going to be the hardest punches out there. And I'm glad you bring up the armbar position from Moroz, because I wouldn't say she's the greatest grappler, but she is a very dangerous grappler when she's able to get the fight in certain positions. She loves going for that armbar. You bring it up. That's how she beat Joanne Calderwood. She gets her, flips around, gets the beautiful armbar, and it's a position that Moroz is very adept at and very experienced with. So you always have to watch out for some of those positions when it does hit the mat, because I think a lot of fighters go in there realizing, okay, I might get out volumed on the feet. I should probably shoot for a takedown here or there. But Marina does, or has done, a very good job of at least making that position that you would perceive as a weakness be a more dangerous position than just, oh, I can stay on top of her and kind of negate some of that output. But we have seen, especially throughout this run from Silva, that if she's able to get on top or at least use her physical strength to isolate different positions of her opponent, there's not a lot of athletes in this division who can really start fighting out of those spots. She does have a, hey, if I'm committed to this Kimura, if I'm committed to the Darce, if I'm committed to the knee bar, it's a difficult spot to get out of. I'm just curious to see if she has enough sustainability in this fight to where, okay, I go for that big submission, I might burn out my arms a little bit, I don't get it. Is she going to have that second tier to her game when Moroz is able to just be on the back foot, throwing that crazy sea of volume at her?
And that's it with Moroz. We haven't really seen the gas tank of Karina Silva in the UFC. It was a question for me coming in. It was also a question of, well, what happens if she gets held down, bogged down, kind of like, and you saw it last weekend in Pollyanna Viana, but what happens if that happens to Karina Silva? And for Marina Moroz, likewise, she was to the nth degree with her boxing in her native Ukraine. We knew her for that, but also, you're such a good boxer, but you go for so many arm bars. It's just really a bit of a clash of styles within her own style. And for Moroz, I mean, a long time training or fighter training out of American Top Team, so she has Carolina Kovalevich to get ready with for this matchup. For Karina Silva, training down in Brazil, Gile Ribeiro team, and she's trained there for a very long time. We've mentioned a lot of the partners or some of the bodies that have been at that gym for a very long time as well. Augusto Sakai, Rogério Bontorin, I mean, man. Whatever happened to that guy? But when it does come down to this matchup, Matt, might surprise some people. Moroz already has a win in this matchup, but Karina Silva about a 2-1 favorite. So go ahead.
And this is the thing about Moroz that I've always had a really difficult time with. Normally, a lot of these fighters, especially in this division, like flyweight, and Moroz was a strawweight before that, they're not the deepest divisions, right? So a lot of these athletes, even if they're outside of the top 15, they will have gone on that one big run throughout their career to kind of make the push. Moroz, for the majority of her career, has kind of been that 12 to 15 or just on the outskirts of the ranking. She never really has that one dominant run that made you think, oh wow, she could be a contender in the future.
The three wins that she had before the Maia fight, that was the run, because then she was favored to beat Maia. But
you're right, it just, even the Maia fight, like, she got beat so soundly in that it just kind of makes you reverse and go, okay, is she just going to kind of be stuck in that 12 to 15 category for the rest of her career? Because like you said, there are some fighters, like Aljamain Sterling, has a complementary skill set. He throws insane volume at you, and then if he gets you to the mat, it's pretty much lights out. For Moroz, a lot of her game is at a high level. It just doesn't fit together like a perfect puzzle.
We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 80% Karina Silva.
I think they're going to be over.
And they are over slightly. 805 total votes, 84% Silva, 68% by submission for the 16% that are Moroz, 78% by decision. In this fight, I have Karina Silva. I'm surprised that she lost the first time that she fought Marina Moroz. In the way that she fought, And as long as the elbows, knees, and toes are tight in for Corina Sylvan, she can avoid some of those bad positions against Moroz. I think she can have success. But when you look at a fight like this, Matt, Silva, it's a lot of big actions with her Muay Thai. And for Moroz, she can kind of dazzle you with a little bit of that volume in the mirror. Maybe Moroz is able to outlast Silva in this matchup, but I do think Silva can get it done.
And I agree with you, and I think a big portion of this fight is going to be that top position from Silva, because if Moroz is able to be squirmy enough off her back to where Silva can't really get a dominant spot to go out there and convincingly win the round, then Moroz, if she's able to get back up to her feet, could just pitter-patter, and do enough in some of those moments to win rounds. But I agree with you, I think the big actions from Silva should be able to win her this fight.
Both of us going with killer Corina Sylvan to get the win. Let us know who you have in this matchup. Some big time fights in this card, including three at middleweight. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
The 13th ranked flyweight in this world, Andrea Lee, looking to hold on to her spot in the rankings as she takes on surging Brazilian contender Natalia Silva in this matchup. And for Silva coming into the UFC, Jungle Fights champ in her native Brazil, she had a really long layoff between 2019 and her fight with Jasmine Jazzavizius because she had broken her arm. She refines her skills. She trains out of a big-time gym in Team Bohacha. She has, well, I mean, if you didn't think about it, Paulo Costa's brother in her corner. And when you watch Natalia Silva fight, from that time until this time, she is much improved. The takedown defense is on point, and she has been mixing it up with her strikes. She beats Jasmine Jazzavizius, beats Teresa Bleda in a performance bonus, beats Victoria Leonardo her last time out, and that fight wasn't even close. So now Silva gets to move it forward, and it's hard to remember for Andrea Lee because now all of a sudden, she's 5-5 in the UFC. She reached as high as 6 in the world, and she's been favored highly to win fights that she's lost in the UFC. But for Lee, she was the legacy champ, she was the LFA champ at flyweight, and everybody since Andrea Lee, who's become an LFA flyweight champ, has become a UFC fighter. We talk about Gabby Fernandez, we talk about Sabina Mazow and Jamie Lynn Horth as well. And for Lee, it'll be interesting to see if we can kind of get back to basics, because what do we know her for? I mean, out of all of these fights, out of all of these wins, the takedown differential in her fights has been a big story. 19-4 to 22 against. It seems like everybody wants to take Andrea Lee down, and as a striker, Andrea Lee likes to take down other women. That sounded aggressive. But when you look at a fight like this, Matt, Natalia Silva is going to bring the strikes, and Andrea Lee, a very accredited striker, 2013 Amateur National Gold Gloves champ, and in 2014, she was a North American WKA Muay Thai and kickboxing champ. So both of these women can butter some bread when it's on the feet with their striking. What do you make of the matchup here?
It's an interesting fight because I think there's two major factors in this matchup. I think this is a pretty big step up in competition for Silva, and I say that because of the experience that Andrea Lee brings into the cage. You're right, her record's, what, 5-5 in the UFC? But all of her fights have been against fairly high levels of competition. Like you said, even before she made the jump to the big organization, everybody on her resume, for the most part, is a pretty good opponent. So for Lee, it's been interesting because at 34 years old, is she an old 34? Is she a young 34? Because she always kind of fights in the same manner. Moving forward, Andrea Lee is a very difficult fighter to deal with. If she is able to stuff your takedown defense, she has, I wouldn't say overpowering shots in the feet, but they are damaging enough to where they can bust up her opponent's face and do enough to go out there and win rounds, especially with her boxing. I know she will throw kicks, but her hands are quite effective and they are fairly accurate too. But Lee, as much as anybody on this card, is a very different fighter moving forward than when she's moving backwards, because sometimes she'll try to wait and time up that big power shot on the back foot, and it does leave openings for her opponents to not only go for takedown attempts, but also bully her up against the cage. And that's a position that we have seen Lee in the majority of her fights, win, lose, or draw. It's a lot of that clinch work up against the cage. It is exhausting work for her and her opponent. And I'll liken Lee a little bit to like an Austin Hubbard, right? Austin Hubbard's somebody who's going to go out there and try to win that third round, and we'll kind of see what happens the first 10 minutes. Lee, for the most part, does have that good sustainability to her game to where she's not going to fall off a cliff and become some completely different fighter. But I will say this, her last matchup against Macy Barber, we did see a bit of a different version of her. She did go for a lot more takedowns and secure a lot more takedowns than I ever assumed that she would have. Now, it was a very close fight, split decision. I rarely really go on MMA decisions, but I was like, I'm curious to see what other people had it as. It was basically split down the middle as like 29-28 Macy Barber or 30-27 Andrea Lee. And I gotta be honest, after rewatching that fight, I can't really disagree with either one of those scorecards. Like, all the rounds were quite close, but for Lee, we didn't see her shoot for a lot of offensive takedowns in that matchup, and I think we're gonna see a very similar game plan from her in this one, because I think at kicking range, she is gonna struggle with Silva, just with the power and the pop that Silva has on the end of her shots. But if Andrea Lee can make this more of an experience fight and use her veteran savvy, I could see her really making this a difficult fight for Silva. But I will say this, if you beat Andrea Lee, it's kind of like beating Jim Miller, right? Like, good things normally happen to you afterwards. So Silva's gonna go from fighting like the Victoria Leonardos of the world to, hey, if you beat Andrea Lee, it's not gonna be an easy fight from this point on, and you're really going to establish yourself as a top contender in this division.
And I mean, listen, the only one that's beaten Jim Miller in the last, what, 5 years that hasn't had that big push is probably Joe Selecki. So if you look at a fight like this, Natalia Silva, does she have an advantage in the striking? It's hard to say. I mean, Andrea Lee, as accredited as I just said, she's a black belt in Kyokushin karate. She's also a crew in Muay Thai in her own right. We'll see if those takedowns work for her, because Silva was able to kind of counteract it against Jasmine Jazzy Vizius, the silver medalist in Canadian freestyle wrestling. It's not like it's a different type. Like Canadian football, the balls are bigger and we have one less
down. The uprights in the middle of the end zone.
But for Natalia Silva, she's definitely carrying a wave of success into this one. For Andrea Lee, she's not just looking to hold on to her spot in the rankings. It's two straight losses. The one to Macy Barber that was incredibly close, a split decision loss, and a loss to Viviane Araújo, where even Lee had her moments in that loss. So we'll see how this one plays out, Matt. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say, I think the fans are going to go crazy on this one. Over, under, 77.5% Silva here.
So I was thinking 70% Silva, so I'll say under slightly.
I'll say under, and it is over. 814 total votes, 88% Silva, 63% by decision, 24% by knockout. For the 12% that have Lee, 80% by decision, I think this is going to be a closer fight than the other three that Silva's had in the UFC. And I don't think that's the wildest thing to say, because, of course, now she's moving herself into the rankings with this one. But Silva, what I like out of her is switching stances on the outside, mixing some of the hooks with the straight shots. And I do like Silva's kicks in a fight like this, especially her kicks to the body. But if you're somebody that's maybe, and I don't like to use this word, but maybe sleeping on Andrea Lee, what you like out of Lee is her clinch is deadly, and the fact that she can also mix it up on the ground is a big bonus, and she's shown that she's got a gas tank for 5 rounds, let alone for 3. So don't necessarily want to sleep on Andrea Lee in this fight, but I do have Natalia Silva here.
I've also got Natalia Silva, but I think it's going to be really important to see when she starts to have success with her own strikes, because if she can hurt Lee, not saying drop her, but at least hit her with enough clean shots to force Lee to start to retreat and not move forward, then I do think Silva's going to have a much easier time than if she's just trying to react to what Andrea Lee's throwing at her on the front foot, because again, Lee moving forward is a difficult fighter to deal with. She has great variety with her shots. She moves her feet well herself, but I agree with you. I think Silva is not only the more heavy-handed striker, I like those kicks to the body too, and for that reason I picked Silva.
Both of us going with Natalia Silva to get the win. Some big time fights on this card, including the next one at middleweight, Andre Petrosky taking on GM3 Gerald Meerschaert. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Andre Petrosky coming up this weekend at middleweight. It's going to look to make it 3 in a row against Gerald Meerschaert. And it starts this weekend. Petrosky looking at his teammate, B. Joe Pyfer, seeing that first round win at UFC 287. Seeing that win at Fury Pro Grappling 7, where Pyfer was able to just grind out Meerschaert and stay on top. And now Petrosky trying to give it that Sean Avery try, just looking for those sloppy seconds to get a win over Florida's own Gerald Meerschaert. Meerschaert, he said in an interview a month ago with friend of the show Ryan Gerald that he's made the move full-time. Seems like back in May he made it down to Killcliffe FC, training with former training partner Brendan Allen from their time at Rufus Sport, as well as all of the big-time bodies that are down there in South Florida at Henry Hoof's gym. So a big fight in this one, because for Gerald Meerschaert, he's got 51 pro fights to his name. He's been in the UFC since about 2016. He got that win over Joe Gigliotti, and then all of a sudden he was fighting in front of Matt and Craig Allen in Halifax.
Poor Ryan James.
Taking on Ryan James, the kind of the hometown guy in that fight. But if you look at it for a guy like Gerald Meerschaert, he is as established as anyone. And so far in his UFC tenure, Matt, there's only been a few fights that have gone to decision. So if you're watching a fight where Gerald Meerschaert is concerned, he's going to be around and finishes are going to happen. And I threw this out there on the weekend. Last weekend, you had Luke versus RDA. And I threw the tweet out and said, how many people go to a bar or a party with friends and they go, man, I'm such a Rafael Dos Anjos fan. Nobody. Nobody's ever heard that.
What are you, even a though, former champion?
Even though Dos Anjos is a former champ and he has the most octagon time accrued by any fighter in the UFC, I've never heard somebody go, man, I just love Rafael Dos Anjos. He's my favorite fighter. The same thing can probably be said for Gerald Meerschaert, but I know we get excited about Meerschaert fights here.
I disagree with the RDA point. RDA's been in a lot of crazy fights, like the Tony Ferguson fight. He might not have won them all, but RDA's one of the more memorable fighters across two of the more popular weight classes. I get excited for Gerald Meerschaert fights, though, and I'm glad you brought up that fact, because Meerschaert is one of those kill or be killed fighters, and I think at this point in his career, everybody kind of realizes what his strengths and deficiencies are. Is he the fastest striker on the feet? No. He looks like he's moving through mud. He is not a fast striker, but he's an accurate one. He does have success on the feet. I'm not saying that to disparage his striking ability.
Watch his fight with Bruno Silva.
Even the fight against Teron Wynn's another good one, too, because it's a fight that goes a little bit later. He's tired, but he starts landing those nice straight shots down the middle, and when he is able to start getting momentum with his striking, it's difficult to slow him down, because what's the last thing you want to do against Gerald Meerschaert? Shoot a double leg takedown on him where your head's in the wrong spot, because he is such a submission specialist and everybody in the world knows that. So Meerschaert is an interesting fighter, and he's a great litmus test, I think, for anybody in the division, because again, if you beat Meerschaert, I'm not saying you're ready for the rankings next, but you're probably going to have to show us a wrinkle of your game that we haven't seen up until that point. Now, the one thing I will say, which kind of goes back on the point I just made, is has the damage just started to accrue too much? Is it gotten to the point to where, hey, once you hit him on the chin, he will go down, because he does have a number of stoppage losses, but in some of his fights, he can eat like an absurd amount of damage to where you're just wondering how he's still in it. So for Meerschaert, I'm really worried about, has he gone past that threshold now to where if Petrosky is able to land that one clean shot, we're not able to see Meerschaert recover and then look good after? Because even though, like, let's go back a little ways, he lost to Thiago Santos by stoppage, but he ate some big clean shots before he ends up going down. And that's been the thing about Meerschaert. If you can hit him early and stop him, great. It's going to look good on your record. But if he is able to get past some of those initial hurdles, he's a really difficult fighter to deal with, even at 35, because his cardio hasn't fallen off even at this age.
And that's it with Gerald Meerschaert. You make the example right there. He loses to Khamzat Chimaev, but since that Chimaev loss, Bartosz Fibinski, he didn't listen to your directive. Shoot that shot on the outside, get your head clocked. And that's what happened. Meerschaert gets the win. The next fight out there, he takes on Makhmud Muradov. Looks like he's going to finish Meerschaert in the first round, tires out. Meerschaert rallies in that fight. Then Meerschaert, and those were both performance bonuses for Meerschaert. He takes on Dustin Stoyfus, kind of rallies as that one goes on. He loses against Christophe Jacko, and that was a little bit of one where you worried a bit, because Jacko was able to have successes in spots where you figured Meerschaert would succeed. He beats Silva, and that fight against Bruno Silva, I chalked that up as a one-off to Silva, but credit to Meerschaert going out there, landing those finishing blows with his strikes to get the win in that fight. He ultimately submits him, but it was his strikes that carried him to the submission, and then a first-round loss to Pfeiffer. And when you look at a guy like Andrei Petrovsky, he actually co-main evented against Rene Souza on that card, Fury Pro Grappling 7, where Meerschaert was taking on Pfeiffer. Petrovsky loses to Souza, a 10th Planet Bethlehem man. But when you go down through it and you look at it for Petrovsky, his dad was always his hero. He was a guy that wrestled at Penn State, was his father, Guy Petrovsky. Maybe it's Guy, but I don't think he's French-Canadian, so I'm going to assume it's Guy because he's an American. So Petrovsky goes to UNC, like the real UNC, where Michael Jordan went, and he wrestles there. And then he wrestles on down through the levels. He went D1, D2, and then I think he went D3 after that. Petrovsky's found himself to be that wrestler, not in disguise. He shows up as the wrestler. There's no kind of forgetting about it. He loses a fight against Aaron Jeffrey with CFFC where he wins the first round with his grappling, and then he gets caught in a submission in the second round. The same exact thing happens on The Ultimate Fighter when he's taking on eventual season winner Brian Battle. He's winning with his wrestling, and then he gets caught in a submission after that. Petrovsky's one of those rare guys where he loses in the quarterfinals, but they still let him into the UFC anyway. He beats Ultimate Fighter alternate Michael Gilmore, out-wrestle him, does get hit by some big shots in the second round of that one. He beats 3-2 Hu Yaozong. That was a weird one. He beats Nick Maximov as a plus 285 underdog, wins in that one, and his last time out. Doesn't get the submission or a finish against Wellington Turman, but he also went 8 of 11 on takedown attempts and had 4 minutes and 32 seconds of control time just in the third round alone. So if you're fighting Andrei Petrovsky, what is it? When he's a southpaw that throws a big sidewinder of a head kick. He throws big punches that completely put himself off balance. And we had a soundbite when Andre Petrowski was to make his UFC debut against Gilmore from UMAT. And you thought that Gerald Meerschaert would be his toughest test.
Exactly. Like, Petrosky's worst nightmare is a guy like Gerald Meerschaert, because if he did move quite a bit more on the feet, then you would like him.
I'm going to go back on what I said and completely negate the point that I tried to make in that video, but I stand by what I said. Again, what's the worst kind of game plan to have when you're fighting a guy like Gerald Meerschaert? Shoot for volume takedowns. Because here's the thing, if you're somebody who can go, like, 2 for 3, not use a lot of your strength and all of your energy, just going for volume takedowns, you're not giving him a ton of opportunity to try to cinch up that neck on some of the in-betweens, and that's where Meerschaert really does shine. Sometimes he can get held down in spots, but sometimes he will be in grappling sequences where, again, like you said, you think he's going to shine, and he might just look a little bit slow, but it's just because Meerschaert's really good at the in-between, so when you are scrambling, if you don't have him in a set position, that's when he will find your neck, find your arm, find your leg, and really make it a much more difficult fight. But that's why I really think it comes down to the age of Meerschaert, just how much he has left in the tank, because if this is Meerschaert from 4 or 5 years ago, to where he can eat some of those bigger shots, and then bring the fight late and start to take advantage of those takedown attempts, then I do think Meerschaert is a perfect kind of fighter to take on someone like Petrosky. But if Andre can just land one or two of those big shots and make Meerschaert fight like a different version of himself, then it will be completely different, and Petrosky could go out there and get a finish. But that's why this is a weird fight. Petrosky's probably not going to get the credit he should get, even if he does beat Meerschaert early, because I do think people realize, hey, Meerschaert, if you can hit him early, again, it's going to look good on your record if you have that early stoppage over him, but we're not going to learn a lot about Petrosky if that's how the fight goes. Meerschaert, again, 10-8 in the UFC, 3 of 18 fights have gone to a decision, and he has lost in decision spots before to Kevin Holland, Eric Anders, and Christophe Jaco. You look at the odds in this one, Petrosky's about a 3-1 favorite or thereabouts. We have a look at the Topology vote. Surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under. I think it may be a little bit closer. I'm going to say over under 70% Petrosky in this one.
I think it'll be over, but it'll be close to 70.
And yeah, so 870 total votes, 78% Petrosky, 50% by decision, 30% by knockout. For the 22% that have Meerschaert, 71% by submission. So Matt, a big time fight between Petrosky and Meerschaert. In this one, I do think Petrosky is going to be able to get the win, but you look at the guys that Meerschaert trains with at Killcliff, and I mentioned a couple of the names. Brendan Allen's a perfect example. There was a guy that was training there to get a couple of guys that are on this card ready, and Chris Curtis recently. You also have Ian Machado Gary, as well as, in a next bout, Gregory Rodriguez trained there as well. So a lot of big bodies to get ready for this one for Meerschaert to get him, you know, season 4 Petrosky, but likewise, Bijo Pfeiffer, Sean Brady, and the like at Marquez MMA for Petrosky.
Exactly. I want to pick GM3 so badly, but I just can't at this stage
of
his
career. A channel favorite.
100%. It's just, Petrosky, like you had mentioned, he is going to go for a lot of those takedowns, but he is a heavy-handed fighter. And the reason I bring up the Deron Wynn fight so much when I reference GM3 is because, what does Deron Wynn do? I know he didn't reach the heights that Daniel Cormier wanted him to, but he's a very talented wrestler who goes for a lot of high-volume takedowns, and he throws looping wide shots in the feet. If I just bring up those facts, you'd probably think I'm talking about Andre Petrosky. I just think Petrosky, a little bit younger, has the heavier hands, and for that reason, I have him in this one.
Both of us going with Petrosky to get the win. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have. Some big-time fights on this card, including another middleweight contest. Gregory Rodriguez taking on Dennis Tallulah. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Weird bit of matchmaking coming up this weekend at middleweight. Looking to rebound off his first round knockout loss to Bruno Ferreira. We have Brazil's RoboCop, Gregory Rodriguez, and he's looking to take on Dennis Tallulah. And why do I say it's a weird bit of matchmaking? Well, first of all, this fight was originally scheduled for January 24th in Jacksonville. The fight was scratched, but they put the fighters back together. And when you fall out of the UFC's top 15 rankings and you kind of go on a little bit of a path and a journey on the internet, you could go to World MMA Rankings, you can go to Fight Matrix, you can go to Topology, and you can see where some of these fighters slot in. And when you go over to Topology, and I know that records are for DJs and rankings are ridiculous, but Gregory Rodriguez on Topology is ranked the 23rd middleweight in the world. Dennis Tallulah is ranked 79th. And this feels like a little bit of a stone's throw, but with a little bit of a catch. Gregory Rodriguez leaves himself out there to get hit and likes to get into wild brawls, even though he's a world champion in jiu-jitsu and a black belt in the discipline. Dennis Tallulah fights like if Rock'em Sock'em Robots were real, doesn't throw many kicks to the legs, only to the heads. Only to the heads, like he's fighting multiple guys in a fight, and he strikes down the middle with power shots. So that's what makes this fight entertaining. If you look at Gregory Rodriguez, loses to Jordan Williams on Contender Series as a favorite. He gets hit by a left hand, and then I counted 15 strikes after the fact, and then he gets finished. Maybe you didn't, but that's how many I counted when I rewatched the fight today. And for Rodriguez, even in his wild fight against Chidi and Joe Kwani, the massive cut on it. His last time out against Bruno, first round knockout loss. So for Gregory, gets ready at Killcliff FC. And there's so many good training partners there. We already talked about some of them, but Brendan Allen, Chris Curtis was there to get Ian Gary ready for a southpaw in Jeff Neal. And I'll talk about that one later on today. But Gregory Rodriguez's main training partner seems to be Canadian out of Gatineau, Quebec, Canada, Marc-André Barrio. Perfect to get you ready for Dennis Tallulah, whose takedown defense has been tested in the UFC, and it's actually surprised me a lot because his takedown defense on the regional scene was porous at best. But for Dennis Tallulah, if any second of a fight is standing, this guy's got a shot.
He definitely does. He's one of the more heavy-handed fighters in this division, and when he is able to get momentum and gain confidence in his own striking, you almost see it on him when he's moving forward. It is a very difficult package to deal with. But for Gregory Rodriguez, I'm going to sound like the oldest man alive because I feel like a lot of people watching MMA now did not watch this guy. But when Chuck Liddell lost his durability, he fell off a cliff. You have never seen a fall of an athlete quite like it. It was like when Brandon Roy had his knee injuries. Like, when the one thing that makes you special gets taken away from you, then you don't necessarily have those other skills to fall back on. And for Gregory Rodriguez, not only is he able to go out there and get these spectacular finishes, but he normally has to face quite a bit of adversity in the early goings of these matchups before he can start to break down his opponent with some of those great boxing combinations and big power shots that we have seen. But if the Bruno fight isn't the exception, if that is just the rule moving forwards, then what version of Gregory are we going to get? We bring up the BJJ in every single one of these videos that we do, but we never see it in his fights. So at a certain point, if it walks like a duck and if it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, then it's probably a duck. So for Gregory Rodriguez, I am concerned that, hey, has he just kind of lost that part of his game? Almost like a Johnny Hendricks. Johnny Hendricks probably beat GSP, even though I'm Canadian and you're not supposed to say that, but it was because he was a heavy-handed striker on the feet, and he had that great wrestling as a base to go out there and threaten his opponents with. But once he stopped using that wrestling and just exposed himself as still a heavy-handed striker, but just not a striker with not a ton of variety, then we did see a much more diminished version of him. And again, for Gregory Rodriguez, if he's not able to eat those 7-8 strikes before he's able to go out there and have his own success, then Dennis Tallulah is one of the worst matchups he could possibly go out there with.
So I showed the picture of the book with GSP. I put a picture up because I've got a Fight Night Pick shoe that's got GSP on it.
You gotta live your truth though, Craig, and I gotta be honest, I thought Johnny Hendricks won that fight.
And Brad Wharton from Cage Warriors, who I was kind of commenting under with the picture of the shoe, said this looked a lot like Paul Sass and less GSP. So listen, England's own Paul Sass. But when you look at it for Dennis Tallulah, loses the first round against Jamie Pickett, and then he rallies back in that one. He drops him once big time, and then he obviously, a couple of cup checks in that one. He did lose a point for that in the second round, but he hits him with a big knee that ends up finishing it. And you're talking about great training partners to get ready for a fight like this. Dennis Tallulah on his Instagram, training with the greatest heavyweight of all time back home, Fedor Emelianenko. So interesting.
A guy who wants to fight Mike Tyson.
Interesting stuff there for him. And for Gregory Rodriguez, I kind of flashed the two up there and I let you make your point. But Gregory, we've seen it twice in the UFC where he's utilized some offensive wrestling and some judo. His fight against Armin Petrosian that he lost by split decision, he utilized the wrestling in that one. Seemed like that was more of a game planning approach, kind of like RDA Luque. I only train to wrestle. That's all I know. But for Gregory in his fight against Jun Young Park, he was able to go out there and you saw that flip that he landed, Koshi Guruma that he was able to do, the big flip that he had against Park to land him on the bottom. I wouldn't be surprised if Rodriguez brings that into a fight like this against Dennis Tallulah. Now, Tallulah, I touched on it, 1-3 in his takedown defense in his debut against Ali Askap Hizriyev. The Black Wolf throws people. So that's what we know out of Hizriyev. He went 5-5 against Jamie Pickett and 2-3 his last time out. Now, did he get finished in the losses? Yeah, he got finished by Jun Young Park. He also got finished by Hizriyev. But Tallulah, a very adept striker. So when we look at this one, Matt, topology vote surprise to us there to you. I'm going to say over under 80% for old RoboCop.
I think it's going to be closer to 50.
It's way over.
Wow.
854 total votes, 93% Rodriguez, 74% by knockout for the 7% that have Tallulah, and 79% by knockout. The fans think somebody's going to get knocked out in Boston. Who do you have to win this one?
I'm going to go with the big underdog in this one. I think Dennis Tallulah has a great chance to win this fight, and this is why. If Gregory Rodriguez does decide to bring out the wrestling shoes, it just makes him that much easier to get hit. He's going to close the distance, and that's not what you want to do against a guy like Tallulah. He is good at landing shots from those weird angles while he's defending takedowns, and I just worry about the durability of Gregory Rodriguez. So I'm going to take a real Hail Mary on this one. Hopefully my arm strength's better than, like, Tua. No, I love Tua. Everybody knows that. But I do like Dennis Tallulah in this matchup.
I honestly thought Dennis Tallulah was one of the strangest signings in UFC history, and now three fights in, the jury's still out on that one. I do have Gregory Rodriguez. I think skill for skill, he's a little bit better in this one, but durability's not a skill. So that's the ultimate X factor in this fight. We're split on the pick here. Matt going with Dennis Tallulah. I'm going with RoboCop Gregory Rodriguez. It is RoboCop. Some big time fights left on this card. The next one, the return of a legend, Chris Weidman taking on Brad Tavares. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Two longtime middleweight vets looking to meet in the octagon in Boston coming up this weekend. We have the former middleweight champ of the UFC, future Hall of Famer, the All-American Chris Weidman. And he's looking to tango with Hawaii's own Brad Tavares. And when you look at a fight like this, this is going to be Weidman's first action since 2021. He broke his leg tremendously, horrendously at UFC 261 against Uriah Hall. And his kind of return to action has been much documented. In 2021, he was out there and there were rumblings that he was going to have to get more and more surgeries on the leg. In 2022, he was kind of teasing a little bit of a return. In 2023, it looked like it was imminent and he competed at Polaris 23. So he was getting into a little bit of grappling shape, but he's kind of said it, and I saw it earlier on this week, the UFC countdown, why I've been talking about just looking to spend time with his kids normally again. And in a lot of different interviews, he did one with UFC Unfiltered with his coach, I guess, or are they even business partners? Because it's long ago, Weidman MMA. But with Matt Serra and Jim Norton talking about the fact that when he gets back in the cage, he wants to be able to kick like normal again. So for Chris Weidman, a big
road... lazy spinning back kicks to get taken down and lose the title?
Well, we'll see. But for Chris Weidman, he really wants to get back to normal. And since fighting Luke Rockhold at UFC 194 and losing his belt, that fight included Weidman's 2-6, so looking to get back to some form of normalcy. And in the wins, he looked amazing UFC fight night, Long Island, when he took on Kelvin Gastelum. And he looked very labored when he took on Omari Akhmedov. Wins the first round, loses the second round, wins the third round. Both guys look exhausted at the end of that fight. So Weidman looking to get back in the win column. For Brad Tavares, the same can be said. He's lost his last two in a row. A highly competitive, almost fight of the night style fight against Dricus du Plessis, where Brad Tavares, hey, looked like he wanted to knock a guy out for once. And for Tavares, his last time out, he gets finished by Blindado. It was Blindado, Bruno Silva. It wasn't just Bruno. It was the real guy. So for Tavares, that fight was actually back earlier on this year. Kind of a short draw for Tavares after a knockout loss, as bad as that one was. But he looks to come into this fight. And Tavares is an interesting guy because grappling for grappling's sake, he's not that bad. 80% takedown defense in a very long UFC career. And if you do consider it, 22 fights there for Tavares since the Ultimate Fighter 11. He only has two knockout wins in that entire span. One guy we won't mention, but the other guy is Christoph Jatko. And so for Tavares, it'll be interesting to see, will he go for leg kicks? Because against Dricus du Plessis in a wild striking affair, Tavares threw six. I'm assuming that's because he didn't want to get taken down. But against Akhmedov, for Tavares' sake, 24 of them. Against Shoeface, 20. Against Jocko, 17. And against Talas Laitis, 23. Brad Tavares, he can kick legs if he decides he wants to.
And he is one of the earlier calf kickers. Like, I remember all the way back when, before it was this huge phase in MMA, it was Benson Henderson, and Brad Tavares didn't get the credit for it, but it always has been a really big portion of his game, and I'm glad that you bring it up, because as of late, he has gotten away from the kicks, at least to the same volume that he was throwing them when he was kind of on his initial rise. But Brad Tavares is another one of these these guys who he's just kind of always been in that 12 to 20 category, and he's never really been able to break through. Now, he has fought really good fighters. He's fought the likes of Robert Whittaker, Yoel Romero, like some of the best fighters, Israel Adesanya in a main event one time.
Edmund Shabazian
head kicked him, but that was kind of wild. But that's always been the thing about Brad Tavares. When he is fighting at his peak, he is a 10 to 15 fighter, I would say. Like, he's a very talented fighter, and you bring up the takedown defense numbers. He just has great takedown defense across the board. He can stuff takedowns in the middle of the cage. He does a really good job with his back up against the cage too, and that's a position where we kind of see fighters make or break their careers. If you're bad with your back up against the cage defending takedowns, you're probably not going to have a very long career doing this. But Brad Tavares has always been able to defend takedowns, get his back off the cage, and you can see how physically strong of a guy he is. He does do really well in some of those clinch exchanges, but fighting Chris Weidman at this stage of his career, it's just a great test for both guys. And I hate to say what I'm about to say, but this feels like a budget cut fight for the UFC. Like, both these guys are very well known, but they're not necessarily in their primes anymore. And you might look at Brad Tavares and think, oh, 35? It's a weathered 35, though. Like, he has been in there with some of the best fighters in the world, and he's taken a lot of damage as a result of those high-level fights. But I liken Chris Weidman at this stage of his career, and I hope you appreciate this, because they stole this guy's gold medal in Seoul, Korea. Now, let's look back at his whole career. Y'all must have forgot. Chris Weidman moving up to 205 was a little bit concerning for me, right? We see fighters...
That was the last time that the UFC was in Boston, and Chris Weidman got... thumped
he
against
did.
Dominic Reyes.
But it doesn't even matter about the result of that fight. I just hate it when a fighter who has had a lot of success suffers a couple losses and they immediately go, let's change weight classes. It's probably going to be the greatest thing for me. Look at Dan Hooker. When Dan Hooker moved from 145 to 155, it was a great career move and he looked really good at 155. Then he moved back down to 145 and Arnold Allen beat the brakes off him, and it was like kind of sad to see that version of Dan Hooker. For Chris Weidman, I know we haven't seen him accept a lot of damage outside of that terrible leg break. The fight against Ahmed was just one of those grueling fights where it's both guys going for a lot of takedowns. I am going to be curious to see how Chris Weidman does accept some of the damage from Brad Tavares, because you bring it up, Tavares isn't the most heavy-handed fighter out there. When he does sit down on his shots, he can land with good power. Like, the Jocko knockout was a really nice one when he's able to close that distance. They're like chest to chest and he lands a massive overhand. I wonder if he's going to have enough power to hurt a guy like Weidman, because at 39 years old, Weidman is no spring chicken. Like, I don't think we are going to see the Chris Weidman who's going to throw the jab out from distance, who is going to go for a lot of kicks. I think we're going to see a very wrestle-heavy version of Chris Weidman at this stage of his career, and if he does do that against Brad Tavares, it might not even be the best game plan, just because of how good Brad Tavares' takedown defense has been. If he can keep it on the feet and tire out Chris Weidman, I could see Tavares looking really good with his boxing, because for as good as Chris Weidman was, even when he was UFC champion, he was never some dynamic fighter on the feet. He is very basic with his striking, and I don't mean that in a negative way. He has a good jab, he has a good right hand, you bring up the kicks, they're effective. But even when he was champ, he wasn't going out there and winning 15-minute, 25-minute fights just strictly with his striking.
No, and Weidman, I mean, a D1, the nickname right there, All-American, but a D1 wrestler at Hofstra. Who else went to Hofstra, Matt? His buddy, John Volante, the football player. But Matt, for Weidman, Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt as well. And we've seen Weidman in this time away doing a lot of other things. I mean, he's on the UFC weigh-in show for the big pay-per-views, and he's having a great time at that. And I bet you when he retires, he'll probably end up with 100%. A job in MMA that
way. He's not going
to
be one of those guys who has, like, a sad after-career. Like, no. Chris Weidman has a ton of opportunities when he's done fighting.
The name is Longo and Weidman MMA, so you get that a little bit. And we have a big-time fighter at that gym in the main event of this card. But he's also spent a lot of time at Upstate Karate with Wonderboy and his dad, training, getting guys ready as well. And we've seen a lot of fighters say, hey, I brought in Chris Weidman to train with for the wrestling's sake. So we'll see how it translates in a matchup like this. Brad Tavares is a pretty heavy favorite in the fight. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise to us, there to you. Chris Weidman got a rod from about his knee to his ankle. I don't think the fans are going to favor him in this one. I'm going to say over under 75% Brad Tavares.
I think it'll be under, but it'll be the favorite.
And it is under, I was going to say 70, and I said 75. 896 total votes, 70% Tavares, 60% by decision for the 30% that have Weidman, 76% by decision. Brad Tavares, MMA math, beat Omari Akhmedov. Chris Weidman beat Omari Akhmedov, so that one's interesting. Matt, when you look at a fight like this, who do you have to win in the fight?
I do have Brad Tavares in this matchup just because I'm concerned about what stage... Like, does Chris Weidman think I'm going to win this and then go on some big run?
No, I think this is like a prove it and then it's done.
And that's kind of what I'm hoping, honestly. Because for Chris Weidman, he had a great career. He had a really nice prime. But he has accepted quite a bit of damage at this stage of his career. Remember the Jacare fight? Like, he got flatlined by Jacare.
Vice versa, remember the Vitor Belfort fight where he's on top, hammering away.
That was 10 years ago, so I'm not as concerned about that fight. My point is, though, for Chris Weidman, I do think we are going to see a much more grapple-heavy version of him in this matchup. And Brad Tavares didn't even get taken down by Yoel Romero that consistently. That's when Yoel was firmly in his prime. So I just think stylistically, I don't think Brad Tavares is going on a run either. Let me get that perfectly clear. But I do think he has the counter to what Chris Weidman does well. And for that reason, I have Tavares.
I like Tavares being steady on the feet. If he gets held up, if he gets slowed down, that's where Weidman could take over. We'll see how it makes out with those leg kicks and this not. And you even heard it out of Vicente Luque winning last night, I thought fairly handily against Dos Anjos, the fact that he was a little tentative in the first round, getting back into actual fighting action. So we'll see how Weidman makes out with the return. We'll see how Brad Tavares makes out coming off of a first round stinger against Bruno Silva. Both of us in this one going with Brad Tavares. Next matchup on the card, it's time, Matt, the young Punisher, Pedro Munhoz. He's taking on Marlon Vera. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
After three straight Fight Night main events coming up this weekend, Chito Marlon Vera looking to rebound off a little bit of a lackluster performance his last time out, taking on Corey Sandhagen. This weekend, originally, he was scheduled to take on Henry Cejudo, but Triple C went over to his YouTube channel back in early July, announcing that he was out. So in steps, near 37-year-old, the young Punisher. Matt, we've done this once before with the channel. You're 37. The young Punisher doesn't cut it. We're finding a new nickname for Pedro Munhoz.
So for the longest time with Fight Night Picks, we've been saying that Pedro Munhoz needs a new nickname. Guys, a couple weeks away from turning 37 and the young Punisher doesn't cut it anymore. Matt, we've done this before. We're throwing darts at a board and we're picking a new permanent nickname for Pedro Munhoz. Let's get into it. All right, Matt's up first. Dart at the board. All right, he's got it. Now it's my turn. You can take the camera. All right. Dart at the board. I know which one I want. And I missed it. All right. It's either Pedro Nova or the Bad Man. Opportunities were the Sao Paulo Punisher, the Jesus, Bonus Machine, Lil P, Munster, that would have been a good one. Brazilian Badger, Larry Leg Kicks, Car Wreck, Brazilian Thunder, and also Dial Up, because this guy dials up the leg kicks. But we went with Bad Man and Pedro Nova, two of the worst ones we could have landed on.
And those are the perils of throwing names on a dartboard. I thought I had some pretty darn good ones. We landed on Pedro Nova and the Bad Man. The Bad Man, Pedro.
The Bad Man might be worse than the Young Punisher, and the Young Punisher's terrible.
Pedro Munhoz. But Matt, Pedro Munhoz looking to move it forward. He was able to drop Chris Gutierrez with a short shot in tight in the first round, his last time out. He beats the leg kicker at the game as a big underdog. And now all of a sudden, Munhoz in a big time fight against Marlon Vera. And I think this is an awesome matchup for these two guys, because for Pedro Munhoz, he's only fought the toughs of the tough since he was in the UFC. Guillotine Machine would have been a pretty cool nickname too, because when he came into the UFC, that was all he was doing. These two guys are also bonus machines, and for Pedro Munhoz, number one all-time fights leader in bantamweight UFC history with 19. This will be his 20th UFC fight. For Marlon Vera, all-time bantamweight finish leader with 10 in his not-so-young UFC career at 30 years old. So I love this fight. Might be my favorite one on the card, and I know you're pretty excited about it too.
Oh, it's a phenomenal matchup between these guys, because for Pedro Munhoz, he's just been in the top of the division for a long time now, and I liken him a little bit to almost like Derek Lewis, but in this division, just because he's fought pretty much everybody in the rankings for, you know, exactly where he's gonna sit. Like, Munhoz might not be a top 5 guy anymore, but he's definitely not in that 10 to 15 category, and that's why I like like him fighting pretty much anybody still trying to make their ascent through the division. And for Marlon Vera, it was a bit of a weird one-off his last time out, because we know Marlon Vera as being that crazy exciting fighter, and you probably assume, hey, him and Corey Sandhagen are going to have a fight of the year caliber fight. It wasn't necessarily that. We did see a much more tentative version of Marlon Vera in that matchup, and I'll kind of go back to his first initial run in the UFC. What was he known for? He was one of the kings of the comeback. He'd lose the first round, he'd be kind of getting his ass beat in the second one too, and then all of a sudden he'd land that one clean shot that completely changed the complexion of the fight. And Marlon Vera doesn't look like the most heavy-handed guy or heavy-legged guy in the world, but he has vicious punching power when he's able to land on guys. The power in his shots isn't that common in this division, and that's why I think this fight's going to be very interesting, because Munoz, one of his defining attributes is his durability. He gets hit, but he's going to march you forward, he's going to use those leg kicks to slow you down, and then once he gets to that range that he can then land his own big powerful hooks, he is a much more difficult fighter to deal with. But if he's not able to eat some of those more long-range strikes from a guy like Vera, who is going to be able to fight from that extra, you know, 2-3 inches back, then I do think Munoz is going to have a difficult time with this fight, and that's why this fight, more than any other, is just going to come down to ranges, because on the inside, Munoz should be able to land his own leg kicks. Now, to Vera's credit, he does check kicks. He's not going to check every single one of them, but he does do a pretty good job defensively with the lower half, and if he is able to start negating some of that portion of Munoz's game, I think Vera's the much more talented striker at distance. Now, again, up close, Munoz has very exceptional punching power, but on the outside, if Vera isn't that really tentative striker, I think he can have a lot of success with his own kicks and power shots, but these guys both kind of need a kick in the ass before they start to really get their game plans going.
And Pedro Munoz is one of those guys that can come out like a banshee in the first round. The Chris Gutierrez fight, the fight against Garbrandt, where you talk about durability, they both crack each other, and Munoz is the one that comes out on the winning end, and that's unfortunate that we don't have Garbrandt on this card. Right now, as we tape this Sunday night or Sunday afternoon, Mario Bautista is still looking for an opponent, and we'll update you as soon as we can on that. Randy Costa's thrown his hat into the ring. He's a Boston-based guy, too, and he's been winning on the regional scene since he left the UFC. But for Munoz, the interesting thing is the knockdown ratio. 7-4 to none against in his UFC career. For Marlon Vera, 12-4 to none against. Both these guys have very good chins. And for Pedro Munoz with the leg kicks, out of his last five fights, we go down through it. 34, 26, 19, 37, and 40 are the totals of leg kicks in those five fights. Of those total fights, 156 of 329 significant strikes have been leg kicks. That's 47% of Pedro Munoz's significant strikes have been leg kicks, including all 26 that he landed against Sean O'Malley. And you had two of three judges scoring that first round for Munoz against Sean O'Malley. Now, the wheels fell off in the second round, and then you had the eye poke, and it's going to be awkward for those two guys, I'm sure, to see each other in the hallways this weekend in Boston. But when you do consider it for both these guys, again, for Marlon Vera, the last time he fought a three-round fight, it was against Frankie Edgar. And one of the judges had it 20-18 for Edgar. The other two had it split. Vera has that crazy kick, and we're off to the races.
That front kick was the thing of beauty.
And again, both these guys, as I said, are absolute bonus machines. So when you consider a fight like this, it will be very, very interesting to see who's able to pull ahead. And if you look at it, and if it touches the ground, these two guys can scramble like the best of them. They both have really, really good ground games. Marlon Vera at Aruka Sport, working the boxing with Jason Perillo. Pedro Munoz, a longtime American Top Team guy. And if you want to see a great Pedro Munoz fight that you might not have watched recently, I know I said this the last time, but his fight against Brett Johns was insane.
It was a really good fight.
Go back and watch that matchup. We have a look at this one, Matt. Marlon Vera is favored in the fight. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say under 72.5% Vera.
I think it's going to be like 80.
I think it's going to be 8.
I didn't think it was going to be 80.
900 total votes, 80% Vera, 71% by decision for the 20% that have Munoz, 91% by decision. I'm going with the underdog Pedro Munoz in the fight, and I think he's going to be able to at least win the first and the second and get it done against Marlon Vera. The kicks, the boxing, and I do like a fast starter to Munoz in this one.
I disagree, and this is why. I think Marlon Vera has a huge X factor that not enough people are paying attention to. On the outside, Vera's not somebody who will just wilt to the kicks of Munoz, right? He's good defensively with them, and he himself has phenomenal offensive kicks. We've seen that throughout his career. When Munoz goes in for his boxing combinations, I think Marlon Vera's going to put him in that plum clinch and throw a ton of elbows and knees up the middle, and I think that's going to help negate a lot of that punching power from a guy like Munoz, because Munoz excels at that mid-range, right? To where he can punch you and throw the leg kick. Marlon Vera doesn't really even play in that range. He's going to either bring you all the way in or fight you on all the way outside. And for that reason, I do like Marlon Vera in this matchup, but I think we are going to see an exciting version of both of them. If there is a feeling out process, I think it's only going to be minutes and hopefully not the whole first round, because these guys can offer one of the great fights of the night if they both show up in their A form.
And to me, again, going with Munoz, go back to me, watch that Brett Johns fight.
But Brett Johns doesn't throw kicks.
The
like
legs,
Marlon
the body,
Vera.
The head. Munoz is on fire in that one. So Matt, we're splitting the pick on this one. You're going with Ecuador's Marlon Vera. I'm going with Pedro Nova, aka the Bad Man. Not Justin
Taffa. I like Thud Jesus, though. That's a good one.
Yeah, Thud Jesus. That was one of the ones that I had written up. Let us know what Pedro Munoz's nickname should be down below in the chat. I'll post a picture on Instagram and Twitter of all of the options that we had there. There's 20 on a dartboard, and we landed on two of the lamest ones I could think of. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it. Ian Gary threw out the news on August 10th that out was his tricky southpaw opponent, Jeff Neal, and all of a sudden, who picked up the phone? It's the Haitian sensation, the UFC's all-time decision wins leader, Neal Magny. And if you think, hey, didn't I just watch Neal Magny fight not that long ago? Yeah,
56 days ago.
Neal Magny picked up a split decision win against his opposite identical fighting partner, both at 6'3 welterweight, Philly Fresh, Philip Rowe. And I think the really interesting thing about a fight like this is, not just as Ian Machado Gary kind of continued to evolve and improve in the UFC. We knew him to have a great judo pedigree and a great boxing pedigree. The former Cage Warriors welterweight champ. He got that win over Jack Grant. Comes into the UFC, withstands some adversity against the likes of Darian Weeks and Jordan Williams. But Machado Gary in some compromising positions against Song Kanon, only to rally back and finish him. And for Gary's last time out, he finishes D-Rod, Daniel Rodriguez. But the really interesting thing for Gary in this one is, you train at a Killcliff FC, and we've got a lot of Killcliff fighters at middleweight on this card. But Gary specifically brought in Chris Curtis to train for this fight to get ready for Neal Magny. He also did what he said he would do after beating Daniel Rodriguez. I'm going on sabbatical. I'm going down to Brazil. And Gary gets himself ready at Shoot the Box with Diego Lima and Charles Oliveira, all the guys that train down there. But Gary, in the last couple of days since this fight was announced, what's he done? Well, I'm already training in South Florida. Let's bring in Phil Rowe. And he's trained with Phil Rowe to get ready for Neal Magny, Magny's last opponent. So this is going to be a big time fight, because for Neal Magny, tough as a $2 steak. He has gotten hit pretty hard in some of these last couple of fights. The two that I always seem to reference, the fight against Max Griffin that Magny won. Every time he got hit clean, he looked like it was over. And against Shavkat Rakhmonov, it wasn't the greatest of showings. We've also seen Neal Magny lose earlier this year against Gilbert Burns, where he got taken down and submitted. But for Magny's last time out against Phil Rowe, outlast, win that split decision. So this is going to be an interesting test for Gary to finally get another one of those ranked guys on his way up. It definitely isn't a Jeff Neal, but Neal Magny had that win over Jeff Neal. So we'll see how Gary is able to assess the fighter that we have in Neal Magny here.
I've been on record saying Jeff Neal is like the worst stylistic matchup at 170 for Ian Gary, and I stick by that. I still think that if Jeff Neal fought Ian Gary this weekend, I would have picked Jeff Neal in that. I will say that right now. Because for Ian Machado Gary, he reminds me a little bit of Jaylen Brown for this reason. The things he does well, he does exceptionally well. He finishes at the rim, shoots threes, takes guys off the dribble, but you have seen some of those weaknesses on his way up the division,
mid-range.
And you just wonder that the left hand, he can't dribble at all. He's good at mid-range. But for Ian Machado Gary, the durability has been there. He has been able to eat shots, but he's been getting hit by those shots, and that has been the really concerning factor. And against a guy like Jeff Neal, who doesn't waste a lot of movement on his strikes, who doesn't have all that extra fat, he throws straight shots with tons of power, I really do think that's going to be the Achilles heel of a guy like Machado Gary. But Neal Magny is a completely different kind of test. Neal Magny is like a 7.5 out of 10 in every single area of MMA. He's good striking forward, he can strike moving backwards, even though that's normally where you see him in compromising positions. He is a good offensive wrestler, has great cardio, but we have seen guys who, when they're able, or when they are specialists and they're able to get the fight to their specialty, he can struggle in all of those areas as well. Think about it. Santiago Ponzinibbio, able to back him up, use the leg kicks to really diminish his movement, hurt him with big power shots. And then on the flip side, RDA was able to take him down and get a head and arm choke. So we have seen Neal Magny have success in pretty much every area of MMA, but we have also seen that at this stage of his career, because he has fought pretty much everybody in the welterweight division, that anybody can have success at their given trait against Neal Magny. So if Ian Machado Ogura can keep this fight on the feet and back Neil Magny up against the cage, that's when you will see Magny really have that higher posture, leave the chin exposed. And Gary does have exceptional punching power. For some of the critiques you can have about his game, he's an accurate power puncher who throws great combinations when he is able to work them in. And I don't know if Neil Magny is going to be able to have that game plan of use the Anthony Smith back up, use my front kicks, and try to overwhelm with volume as the fight goes on. Because volume can probably hit Ian Machado Gary, but I'm not sure if it's going to be enough to really hurt him and make him change up his own game plan.
And Neil Magny's had big spots in the past. Main events against Ponzinibbio, against Chiesa, against Kelvin Gastelum, and that was a fight in the night against Gastelum. You look at it for Magny. On UFC pay-per-view cards, this is his record. He loses to Gilbert Burns. He beats Anthony Rocco Martin in a fight that maybe it'll mirror this one against Gary. He beats Li Jingliang, and he also has a win over Carlos Condit. So Neil Magny, 3-1 on pay-per-view main cards.
He lost to Damian Maia on a pay-per-view, but that was prelims.
That was prelims. So for Neil Magny, very good record on the main card when the lights are shining the brightest, and this opportunity in Boston is a big one for sure. And if we go back and look at Magny's last performance against Phil Rowe, first round was razor close, and then I thought Neil Magny had won at 29-28, but it was a close fight nonetheless. And if you look at these two guys, I'm not a numbers guy, but maybe once every card or once every couple of cards, I'll bring up the significant strike differential. For Ian Gary in his young UFC career, 6.85 strikes landed per minute to 4.09 absorbed. For Neil Magny, 3.52 landed per minute to 2.25 absorbed. Neil Magny doesn't get hit nor hit clean all that often. He's very durable. His cardio from Elevation Fight Team, I wouldn't say it's legendary, but it is very good, and it's especially tuned in for three-round fights like this. So I think this is going to be a really good one. Interesting, obviously, for Ian Machado Gary going Florida, Brazil, Florida, and now on really short notice, bringing in Phil Rowe to train with Neil Magny, and then you got that flight over to Boston. So when you look at a fight like this, I'm sure Ian Gary will be favored quite a bit. We have a look at the Tapology vote. Surprise to us there, to you. I'm going to say over under 85% Ian Machado Gary in this one.
I think it'll be a big favorite, so I'll say over.
And it is over, so 567 total votes, 92% Gary, 26% by decision, 64% by knockout. For the 8% that have Magny, 72% by decision. Matt, when it does come down to this one, Neil Magny has been finished by knockout twice in his entire career.
But he's been dropped numerous. Like, even yes. You bring up the Kelvin Gastelum fight. Gastelum drops him, like, three times in the last two rounds. Because Neil Magny, yes, he might not get hit clean all that often, but when he does, he goes down. And Ian Machado Gary, again, I have a lot of criticisms about his game. If you've watched our videos, you probably think I absolutely hate him. I don't. I just think he does have a chance to be that next big star in the division. So I would prefer to see him fix those holes before he starts to fight guys in the top.
Do you like Machado Gary now more than you like Jack Della Maddalena after the Basil Hafez fight?
No, because Jack Della Maddalena won that fight easily. I know that. Yeah, you can make that face.
What?
There is a better argument for him having a 10-8 round in the third than any Hafez winning that fight. I stick by that 100%. Ian Gary, I think that would be a great fight, and hopefully they are kind of building towards that. But I think Ian Gary's just a tough stylistic matchup for a guy like Neil Magny. Unless Magny's able to go out there and get a high volume of takedowns, which could happen. We have seen him use the wrestling in the past. I just don't know if Magny's going to be able to get enough respect on the feet to then open up that part of his game.
We'll see if Magny versus Martin or Magny versus Lawler, we end up with a fight like that against Ian Machado Gary. I do give the edge to Gary in this one.
I liken Gary's game a little bit to like Lorenz Larkin, though. And again, if you guys haven't watched UFC for a long time, you probably don't even know who he is. He's in Bellator now. But Larkin marched Neil Magny down, used the leg kicks to get closer to him, and once he was in that boxing range, he was able to land great elbows and power punches. And I do think Gary can follow a very similar game plan.
Both of us going with Ireland's Ian Machado Gary. Hopefully after he wins, he's not like another Irish superstar that had to feed Anthony Joshua beer and Conor McGregor. Will that guy fight KSI?
Robert Hellenius, first of all.
Will he fight KSI? Will he fight Michael Chandler? Who knows? He keeps saying Chandler, but coming up this weekend, some big-time fights. Two title fights up at the top. Zhang Weili taking on Amanda Lemos, Aljamain Sterling, Sean O'Malley. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Event this weekend at UFC 292. We have the strawweight title on the line. It's Magnum Zhang Weili taking on Amanda Lemos. Out of 36 total wins combined between these two ladies, 30 total finishes. They know how to get it done in impressive fashion. For Amanda Lemos, her last time out, finished a top contender in Marina Rodriguez, and it was an amazing finish as that fight went on for Zhang Weili. First round, defending some of those takedowns from Carla Sparzer, making her really uncomfortable on the feet. And in the second round, she was able to get it done by finish. So for Zhang Weili, second time as champ in this division, 2020 fight of the year against Joanna Janjacek. She's fought a who's who in her 9 fights in the UFC. And that's the crazy thing about both these women. They've only had 9 fights each in the UFC. They're both 7-2 in the UFC, but one of them I consider a future Hall of Famer, and one of them is not even on the fringes of that just yet. Now, it could become the truth when this fight comes up this weekend, and how apropos to say the truth, because this fight is in Boston, and I doubt Paul Pierce will be there. But when you look at a fight like this, Matt, this is not a clash of styles. These two match up really well together.
They do match up really well together, but this is a carbon copy of another women's title fight that we had not that long ago. It was a few years now. This is exactly like Amanda Nunes versus Jermaine Duranemi Part 2. Because what is Amanda Lemos great at? She's a phenomenal striker who can knock out anybody in this division. Like, her striking is as pure and as powerful as arguably anybody we've ever seen. Now, yes, Joanna throws better variety. She has better elbows and whatnot. But again, if Lemos lands on you, there's a chance you just don't make it out of the round. Whereas Weili, like you say, they do match up well because Weili is a very talented striker in her own right. But Weili does have those other parts to her game that we don't often see in all of her fights. But she has at least shown us enough of her offensive ground, her defensive grappling, her ability to go for submissions on the mat as well and implement her own ground and pound, to where Weili can probably strike with Amanda Lemos and be okay. But if she takes it to the mat, it's going to make her path to victory so much easier. But again, I bring up that GDR versus Nunes fight because when Nunes was on the feet with Jermaine Duranemi, even though Amanda Nunes is a much better fighter in the whole grand scheme of things, she was still having difficulties in some of those ranges of her opponent's wheelhouse. And I can see this fight following a very similar script because of how talented Lemos is on the feet. And I think her power is something that differentiates a lot of Weili's past opponents from Amanda Lemos. Because yes, Rose was able to knock her out with a head kick, but Rose isn't the most heavy-handed. She's just very smart, very crafty, and going to make you zig when you should zag. Whereas if Amanda Lemos is able to land one or two shots, be it lucky or set up, it could completely change the complexion of the fight.
Well, and I can already hear people out there grumbling in their car, on the plane, listening at home on the couch. They're going, wow, Amanda Lemos, didn't she just get finished by Jessica Andrade? She did get finished in that fight. That was back in April of 2022. But since then, she had the performance bonus, the second round submission win over Watterson Gomez, and then she also had the Marina Rodriguez.
The Watterson Gomez fight was messed up to put together.
Knockout win as well. Yeah, it was a get back on the horse type of fight if we've ever seen one. And I think Zhang Weili would have probably done the same, if not worse. But when it does come down to a matchup like this for Amanda Lemos, she comes into the UFC at bantamweight against Leslie Smith, has a wild fight of the night where she gets finished in that one, and then takes a lot of time off and fights Miranda Granger, and then continues the move through. She beats Mizuki in a way. Mizuki, where's she been since that fight? We don't know. She also had that finish win over Montserrat Conejo, where we went, hey, Montserrat, where'd she go? Apparently to lose a fight against Jacqueline Amram fairly handily. But for Lemos, we'll see how it goes in this one. She has a really good variety of strikes, and she is really tricky for a lot of these women to figure out. But if you get past the initial storm of Lemos, we saw that in her fight against Angela Hill. Drops her in the first round, goes in for the finish, loses the second round, loses the third round. Still gets the win in that one, because first round being a 10-8, but the cardio, it can get tested.
I like that a little bit, though. Like, Yair Rodriguez is better than Jeremy Stephens, but he also had a really difficult end to the second fight, I guess, because the first one ended so quick, because he dropped him with a body kick, went for a ton of ground and pound. So, for Lemos, I know you bring up that Hill fight a lot, but still, Lemos showed the skills in that says, hey, if she lands clean on anybody, the fight could be over just like that. And for Weili, that has been not a criticism in her game, but sometimes she will find herself waiting on the outside and not using her volume to the fullest of potential. Because when Weili is at her best, you're thinking about the boxing, you're thinking about the takedown entries. She can throw kicks very well too, but it really does come down to, is she the one leading the dance or not? Because when Rose was able to really set her up for that head kick, it wasn't the fact that Rose hits as hard as Amanda Lemos. I can assure you, if they did one of those punching machine things, Amanda Lemos is probably going to have a much higher number. It's probably the least scientific thing I've ever used to describe a fight, but Lemos, I don't think, can set her strikes up to the degree that someone like Rose can. Rose Namajunas is more like a Chris Paul, to where Amanda Lemos is like a Darren Williams, you know?
owning four to seven, eight, kind of. But when you look at Zhang Weili in this one and in her overall career arc in the UFC, training out of her native China, becomes a champion, ends up training at Fight Ready down in Arizona. It's the champ camp. Henry Cejudo, you get Deiveson Figueiredo, the championship whisperer. She loses her belt. She beats Joanna in the second fight, and then Zhang Weili goes down to Thailand, and she's been there training with the Hickman brothers at Bangtao Muay Thai, and for this one, looks like she's kind of moved things to the States just before the fight, training out of Syndicate with John Wood, so I anticipate to see maybe John Wood, Frank Hickman, George Hickman in her corner when she makes it down to Boston, but when you look at a fight like this, Zhang Weili was a almost a 4-1 favorite when she took on Carla Esparza for the belt in that matchup. She's a favorite in this one as well. You have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprised us there to you in this fight, but I'm going to say over under 80% Zhang Weili to retain the belt.
I think it'll be over.
I think it is over. Oh my. 1,014.
See, I disagree with it even though I say it's over for the reason that I said. On the feet, Lemos is as good of a fighter as Weili has ever fought. So if Weili can't get her down to the mat, we could very well see Lemos stay on the back foot, land power shots, and not throw a crazy volume that tires her out.
1,014 total votes, 93% Zhang Weili, 58% by knockout, 18% by submission for the 7% that have Lemos, 76% by knockout. So definite finishing abilities. At strawweight, 30 combined finishes and 36 total wins in this one. But who do you have to get the win here?
I do have Weili, but there's a reason I keep on bringing up the GDR versus Nunes fight. That fight was another situation where the champion is a big favorite and everybody expects her to win. That fight was way closer than it should have been, just because when you do what your opponent's specialty is, it makes you go to plan B and plan C. And luckily for Weili, she does have those areas of her game. She is that well-rounded. But again, it's going to force her to really show all of her game plan to go out there and win this fight. But I do still have Weili.
I think Weili can get it done. Again, you brought it up. It'll be interesting to see if she's able to give it the pitter-patter on the outside like a Letterkenny. And if you look at Zhang Weili, I think that X factor is the fact that she could go with the offensive grappling in this matchup. We'll see how the Marichal brothers put together game plan for Amanda Lemos in this matchup. But for both of us, we're going with Magnum Zhang Weili to retain the belt, keep it going, and get us set for a big-time main event. The bantamweight strap is on the line. Aljamain Sterling taking on Sean O'Malley, a fresh matchup there. You're not going to want to miss any of it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. You're back. You're with Fight Night Picks. And as always, one half your host, Newell Craig Allen, X and Instagram at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left,
it's
you're
still
right.
Still Twitter to me, damn it.
He's back. It's Matt Allen FNP. And for all the conspiracy theorists out there, Matt, you got me a piece of the Berlin Wall.
I was in 5 countries in 2 weeks.
Look at that. Matt is back and getting excited for a big time main event. You can see it over there. Aljamain Sterling in his 6th straight title fight, looking to defend the strap against Sugar Sean O'Malley. And this is an awesome fight at bantamweight because you always love to see new fresh matchups. And for Sean O'Malley, I never would have thought that he would beat Piotr Jan. See how excited I am. I scored that fight 29-28 O'Malley, and I was in the minority in that one, I know. MMA decision, 7-30-27s for Jan, 18-29-28s for Jan, and 1-29-28 for O'Malley. That was Matt Wells, friend of the show, but I thought Sean O'Malley get it done. But regardless of that, it was a really close fight. O'Malley ends up, after Sterling's last title fight against Henry Cejudo, coming in. He's got the leather jacket on, or does Marab. And then we end up with a fight matched up like this. And this is a big-time fight because for the longest time, we've heard about Sean O'Malley and his grappling credentials. He's got his brown belt from Augusto Mendes, who was a UFC fighter at the MMA lab. He's got Tim Welch as a buddy, a podcast host, and also a coach at the gym. Sean O'Malley has so many darn good grapplers at that gym, whether it's Casey Kenney, whether it's Marcus McGee. Where'd that guy come from? There's a lot of very good fighters at the MMA lab to get Sean O'Malley ready for a fight like this. Now, is O'Malley, does he have D3 All-American status twice over like Aljamain Sterling? Can he out-grapple Henry Cejudo? Well, I haven't seen that out of O'Malley, but I have seen it out of Aljamain Sterling. And for Sterling, when he first came into the UFC, nobody was really sure. He just really couldn't get it done. But of late, again, 9-fight win streak for Aljamain Sterling. The sky's the limit, and he's been just absolutely beating some of the best competition that he can. So when it comes down to a fight like this, Matt, I know the fans are going to be excited. I know the Boston faithful are going to cheer for a guy whose last name is O'Malley.
Definitely.
But when it comes down to this matchup, Matt, I know you're excited as I am for it.
I think this is a tremendous fight because, again, Sean O'Malley is still a top contender, but I do feel like there's unknowns out there about him. And Aljamain Sterling is one of the great truth tellers in all of MMA. If you have a single weakness in your game, Aljamain Sterling's going to go out there and exploit it because not only is he a good striker, he is a tremendously talented grappler. Everybody knows that now. Does the guy get tired as fights go on? Not really. The first yawn fight. But for the most part, Aljamain Sterling can not only throw a crazy high level of volume, he does have a really good gas tank to go along with that high level of volume, which makes him a difficult fighter to go out there and game plan for. Because if you're trying to figure out a weakness in Sterling, okay, maybe you can knock him out if you hit him with a clean shot. But if that's all you're relying on in training camp, then what are you really trying to bring into the cage with you? But there's a storyline in this fight that I hate, and we have to bring it up. I hate the fact that Aljamain Sterling is 34 and he keeps on talking about the fact he wants to move up to 145. There is a point where every single fighter just can't fight at a division anymore. Look, Terrence Crawford just fought Errol Spence Jr. not that long ago, was at 147. And a big conversation after that matchup was, well, Spence was too drained at that weight. He's going to fight at 154 to get the full potential out of him. For Aljamain Sterling, I don't like it when champions start talking about moving up in weight because the weight class isn't as easy for them to make anymore. And we have seen Sterling get hit by big shots, get hurt by big shots in the past. In that first Yan fight, he was getting lit up until that big knee. The Marlon Moraes knee is one of the most insane knockouts you will ever see in your life. It's just for Sterling, we have seen him get stopped before. We've definitely seen him get hurt before. And if he is flirting with moving up to 145, and let's say he does have a difficult weight cut, then those chips in his armor are going to be there for a guy like O'Malley to take advantage of. Because the thing I really like about Sean O'Malley is he's not going to be a guy who's really going to fight like a Max Holloway, right? He's not as in your face with his volume, but he's a sniper on the outside. And if he can time one of those big power shots as Sterling's going in for a takedown like Marlon was able to do, or with some of those great long-range punches that he can throw out there, I could see him clipping Aljamain and getting a knockout even early on in the fight, even though I think Aljamain Sterling is the more skilled athlete out of these two. I think there's more areas to his game. But Sean O'Malley does have that exceptional punching power and speed to go along.
So Aljamain Sterling turned 34 on July 31st. It's very newly minted 34 for Aljamain Sterling. You said he's got chips in his armor. Like potato chips? Like
chips,
Pringles?
No, like a little, you know, chips on metal.
Chips on metal. Chips on metal in the armor. All right. We're glad we got
there's
past
chips
that one.
In his armor. Like that's all
Old
it is.
Old Dutch Lays?
It just for Aljamain, we've seen him get hurt. Everybody knows that. But if you are fighting at a weight class to where you really are draining yourself and you are depleted, what are the two things that normally get affected the most by that? Your cardio, which Aljamain Sterling normally has pretty good, or your durability. And if Sean O'Malley is able to time one of those knees going up the middle or a big straight shot, even though Aljamain does have all those other skills at his disposal, we might not even see them if O'Malley can hurt him early.
And Sterling, it'll be really interesting to see how he fares as it goes on. You already touched on his durability in his last fight against Henry Cejudo. Split decision win there. I had him winning the first, the third, and the fourth. Derek Cleary somehow scored the fifth round for Aljamain Sterling, and I thought that was one of the wildest things ever. But when you go back and you look at a guy like Sterling, extended grappling sequences, he was all over Cejudo at certain points of that fight. It was definitely a show-me situation, and Cejudo was supposed to be on this card taking on Marlon Vera. Unfortunately, Cejudo fell out. The other thing for Sean O'Malley that makes this one all the more interesting, this is his first five-round fight in the UFC. It's his first five-round fight, and he came in on Contender Series, A Phoenix Rising, Season 1, 2017, finishes Alfred Kashakian, gets the two knockdowns in that one, we're off to the races. Now, it's got to be awkward for O'Malley because he still clings to that I'm undefeated thing, and Marlon Vera's on this card, so you got to see him kind of prowling around in the back. But when you look at a guy like Sean O'Malley, whether it's the win over Piotr Jan, where he struggled defending the takedowns, but he was able to strike at range, which was a surprise to everybody, whether it's the fights that he's had against Pedro Munhoz, where he gets kicked, but he rallies back, Haulin Paiva, Chris Moutinho in a fight of the night, that was kind of like a here you go, Moutinho, it's a fight of the night. Sean O'Malley, when it's at distance, with his kicks, with his straight shots up the middle, he is almost second to none in this bantamweight division. We've had to see that slow progression up. now he finally finds himself in that title fight opportunity.
You know what would have been phenomenal? Because I agree with you 100%. Even think back, and I brought this fight up earlier, when Israel Adesanya was really getting that heavy promotional push from the UFC, they wanted him to fight for the title, right? But what did they make him do first? He had to fight Brad Tavares in a 5-round fight to almost kind of prove it to the organization that, hey, I am ready for that moment. So that's a really good point that you bring up. It would have been nice, and hopefully you appreciate this. What if Sean O'Malley fought John Lineker in like a 5-round main event or something? Like, I know
John Lineker would have to make the weight first.
Exactly, but you get the idea. If he had just fought one of those guys who's really going to go out there, test him for the length of the 25 minutes, hit him with some big shots, get hit by some big shots, it would give everybody a much better idea as to how O'Malley's going to look in this matchup, because I think O'Malley can catch Aljamain early in a lot of rounds, but in round 4 and 5, I'm not going to guarantee anything. But from what I know about Aljamain Sterling, if he can get any form of grappling off in those rounds, he should be able to have tons of success.
Well, and I already touched on it at the very start of this video, Sean O'Malley, the quality of training partner, coaches that he has at the MMA lab. If you look at Aljamain Sterling, well, you had Dennis Bazookia come in on short notice in the UFC not that long ago. Mrab Dwashvili, Chris Weidman is going to be on this card, Matt Frivola. The list goes Nazem Sadikov. It just continues to go. And it'll be interesting to see if Matt Serra ends up cornering, because he did corner Sterling's last time out there. And
Sterling's always in the gym, too. That's the thing. Like, when you look at other guys' Instagrams who train with Aljamain, he's always there, which is a nice thing to see.
And whether he's in Vegas watching the fights, he's always there at the PI training. We have a look at Fight Night Picks for the total votes on this one. They will not show up on YouTube, but that'll be an interesting thing. So let us know. 61% going with Aljamain Sterling to get the win in this one. Chandler Witt going out on a limb, mentioning everybody that Sean O'Malley trains with. We got Sean 8 ready for this, in my opinion. Will be good for Mrab if Aljo loses TBH. Mark Sportiello saying, card was never that great from the start. Even more sad now. Sugar Sean by KO. Wow. And Bill Cipher saying, Bantamweight's kind of a mess. Two dudes that barely beat Piotr Jan are fighting for the belt. I thought that Aljamain Sterling in the second fight against Piotr, that was pretty one-sided. Yeah. But for me, when it comes down to making a pick in this one, we'll have a look over on Tapology to see if they're close. 72% actually have Sterling there. So more on Tapology have Sterling than we have on our YouTube right now. But for me, I do have Sterling in this one, though Sean O'Malley's shown me more. Even though, yeah, he's got the performance bonuses in the fight of the nights against some lower-level guys. What he was able to do against Piotr Jan on the outside, there's a possibility that he can do the same thing against Aljamain Sterling there, but I do have Sterling. I think the wrestling attack could be a little bit too heavy, and I think that Sterling gets the win in Boston on the weekend.
Fighting Aljamain Sterling seems like you're fighting quicksand. Like, the more you move, just you're going to get yourself in worse and worse positions, because he is such a talented grappler from that perspective. He might not go out there and get a ton of submission wins. He does have submission wins, don't get me wrong, but it's just the fact that he's going to tire you out, break your posture. If you get back up to your feet, you're going right back down, and he threatens with so much that if O'Malley can't hurt him within those first two rounds, I wonder how much pop is still going to be on his shots if he's defending all of these grappling sequences. So I do have Aljamain Sterling ultimately in this matchup. But again, I hope I've said it enough times. If Sean O'Malley, this is how I'll say it. I think Aljamain Sterling more often than not would win this fight, but O'Malley could win it by first round knockout, and I wouldn't be surprised. You can't often say that in a fight.
Some big time matchups on this card, the two title fights. We need to know from you, what's your nickname for the young Punisher, Pedro Munhoz? Let us know who you have there. It'll be on our Instagram and Twitter, at Fight Night Picks. Question Mark Kicks live 2 hours before the prelims this weekend. I don't have any vacations planned in the near future, I don't think.
I don't.
Matt does either. Probably use those up for a while, but make sure you tune in with all of the content. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say. Let's get into it.